and I currently, and I, as I'm currently speaking, I'm actually speaking from Delhi. And I look at what's going on around me, and it just completely rocked me. The aspirations of people, the immense sense of liberation that you find, and the expression for that liberation, in terms of wanting to get the latest, see the best, be experience the best. It's just amazing, you know. So, and where does this sort of, what happens to that wealth? And then people start, young people start looking at, where would I like to be next? And it's oh, I'd lo absolutely love to have that, that studio apartment overlooking the river in Singapore. And it's straight away Singapore becomes a center of wealth, and Dubai has amazing experiences, and all of a sudden. So I would say that the creation of wealth, the management of wealth, is an opportunity, and it's happening at a, in a, in a way that's far more democratized than was ever before. So I think that there is an opportunity, finally, with the combination of technology and generative AI, to start actually including people who are outside that sector of opportunity, the segments of opportunity. And you can see it around. You still see the poverty, but at least you know that, a lot of that information gap, that social friction that didn't allow people to move from one level to another, is actually going away.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Heads Talk with me, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter, the podcast where we talk to C-level executives, leaders of institutions, and heads of multinationals. What are the current topics they talk? We listen.
Can you imagine getting into a business or a market where you actually spend $100 billion plus on a piece of paper?
Are you kidding me?
It was like a frying pan to the head.
I got nothing against CFOs.
It was not just the job of a lifetime, it was the job of 1,000 lifetimes.
My guest today is a fintech expert and an adjunct professor. With a plethora of articles to his name, he is widely respected as an influential individual in the banking and financial world. His coverage includes Dubai, Singapore, Delhi, the Middle East, and Africa, and his influence spread to as far as Europe as well. This is a new series on Heads Talk where we talk to individuals that are leading the conversations in fintech. But before we get into that, here's a brief message. Axia OneCloud provides secure geo-redundant backup capabilities enhanced with cybersecurity. It is the world's only cloud integrating cyber protection with Atlassian products, trusted to accelerate digital transformation by the best organizations around the globe. You can secure your data confidently with protection of more than 20 workload types. Discover what backup and data protection capabilities you gain with the Axia One Cyber Protect Cloud. Harness the power of one solution, one agent, and one console. It delivers the comprehensive cyber protection you seek. Axia operates over 20 cyber secure data centers across the globe. For more information, contact us at www.axia.com.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
Sanjeev Purushottam is the founder and CEO of Bridge DFS, a digital financial services design and advisory firm with regional focus on Asia, Middle East, and Africa. Its focus is to work with payment service providers, banks and telco, as well as venture capital firms, global NGOs, foundations, governments and regulators to develop digital payments, digital banking and digital commerce. Let's start. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Sanjeev to Heads Talk. Delighted to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Elaine. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, I want to get right into this episode with you. By first asking for a detailed introduction to your role, some of your accomplishments that I weren't able to outline in the introduction, and your organization's Bridge DFS. What are the aims and current projects? First, your role and accomplishments.
Thank you so much, Elaine. I am primarily what you would call an expert in the area of financial technology and financial services, primarily from driving technology into business. The firm Bridge DFS started off initially as a consultancy firm in design of financial services products, along with a partner, my founding partner, Rajiv Bhatia. And the both of us went about with the belief that we would be able to use design thinking and our innate very strong consultative selling skills to be able to talk to banks and financial institutions about moving the needle mm-hmm. on digital transformation. And then I think, you know, a couple of things happened, interesting things happened that helped us transform. So we had some really good clients, including the India Post Payment Bank, Citibank, you know, Aramex, and a bunch of others, which really did a lot of good for us as a company. But we got hit by COVID, and the consultative selling business sort of became a little difficult to do in those circumstances. Because most of the time we were actually just getting onto a plane, going across to meet up with our customers, you know, customers as far away as Mauritius, India, Singapore, and, you know, covering all that area. And then COVID put a stop to that. And I don't think it was quite the same with during that time. So we kind of hunkered down, focused on a couple of big projects. And then we sort of transformed the company towards the latter half, in fact, towards the end of last year, towards the beginning of this year, into becoming more of a conduit for enabling relatively mature fintech to move in from good markets like Singapore and Sweden. And I say good, not in a negative way, but it's just that these are the markets that have, have had a good strategic vision about financial technology as it applies to, you know, the banking sector. They've taken a very mature approach towards B2B fintech, these two countries. And more importantly, they've also created a very strong ecosystem for well-funded and extremely robust financial technology companies that have the ability and the strength to be able to go much beyond their relatively small markets into the much wider Middle East and Africa world. So that would give you a little bit of a background in terms of Rajiv and I. You know, I've worked in American Express for 20 odd years, with MasterCard for 11 years. Now that's beginning to date me. And then when I add in Citibank for a year and a half, that really dates me. But I mean, you're an adjunct professor along the way. but I've been an adjunct professor on the way, and, you know, written articles, been a columnist, had a very, very fulfilling, extremely strong innings. And the funny thing is that every time I get up and start off my work, I feel like it's a brand new day, like as if I'm just out of grad school and starting my job once again. You know, that's just an immense. So in short, Bridge DFS is probably one of the, you know, a preferred conduit for establishing a beachhead for companies that want to enter into Middle East and Africa, especially companies from, you know, robust economies like Singapore, Sweden, some of the Western European countries. And we are looking at exploring Australia as another country from which to source fintech.
Excellent. So good. You give me sort of a sense of what's happening in the established fintech markets, like the Singapore markets, and you're trying to sort of bridge that gap with the younger markets looking to the Middle East and stuff and Africa. So please provide an overview of what's happening with some of those subsets of fintech and neobanking, in particular in the target markets you talked about with the Middle East and Africa. Maybe not Australia at the moment, but let's look at, I don't know, RegTech, InsurTech, WealthTech. What new and current, especially with the advent of generative AI, what has that allowed you to do easily that you couldn't have done before? So some of the things, if you could talk about that.
Oh, I could write. Well, I could write books, but I probably asked ChatGPT to write it for me. But the reality is that there is no end to the creativity it has unleashed, right? And I would say that, you know, and I was looking at a very interesting video from a short reel, you know, in which Elon Musk talks about the importance of labor and the availability of talent and labor to be able to create almost anything, and that there is really no lack or scarcity of anything other than an artificial lack of scarcity. What we've come to a watershed moment in human history, where there really aren't any constraints, capital constraints, talent constraints, in most areas, that would enable anybody with a great idea, a robust and a good idea, to be able to translate that into a strong business model without having to go through some of the hoops and the, you know, capital adequacy requirements that would have probably been in place prior to generative AI. And I mean that anybody, literally anybody can start off, first of all, the most important thing, learn, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't know much about banking regulations in a market, get your friendly AI on board and learn everything that you need to know about the regulations in that market. Learn what it takes to be able to operate in that market. You've got all this research work. It's no longer, having to hunt and peck through reams and reams of websites and stuff like that. It's just, it's a continuous stream of information. And of course, you've got to be careful about it. And that's where you need a little bit of intelligence, a certain amount of discernment. But by and large, you can very easily create a robust business model. And then it's a question of implementation. And that's where the second part of this tool called AI comes in, which is that you can now start your process of proselytizing and getting your message out there, socializing your message, getting people to know about what you want to talk about, your unique value proposition. And you don't need to depend upon huge, marketing dollars to be able to do that.
Yes.
So it's, it's an amazing opportunity. I would say that all of a sudden, we are at a moment when there will be millions of new ideas, not thousands, but millions of new ideas, each fighting and vying for place. And there will be, in my opinion, micro markets, which will be profitable. Because each one of those markets does not require the kind of scale that would have been required in a brick and mortar business or even in the erstwhile internet world. So it's an amazing new opportunity, completely new economics. And that's what I think generative AI has done for us.
I think it's interesting what you say, because what I'm picking up, because you know that old phrase that talent is distributed across the globe. It's opportunity that isn't. And what you're saying now, with the advent of generative AI, not only is talent distributed across the globe, but opportunities allowed through AI, through generative AI. So therefore, this almost the sky's the limit. That's what you're saying, really, isn't it?
I actually don't even think the sky's the limit. it's limitless, infinite possibility, and that's what I love about. I'm not saying that I'm a big fan of Elon Musk, or I'm not a fan of Elon Musk, but I just love that clip of his, which talked about the infinite possibility when you have the right combination of labor and talent.
Excellent. So still sticking with that question, about the Middle East and Africa and what's happening currently with those subsets of RegTech, InsurTech, and WealthTech, who do you think is missing out on this new growth, this surge? Who or what is missing out?
Well, if you look at it, okay, it's a touchy question because and I hope that people don't misconstrue what I'm saying. And I'm not saying this to critique any existing incumbents or anything of that sort. That's not my point of view, right? But I would look at it very factually, and today, if you have a machine of some kind, which is when I'm talking about a business machine, a business model of some kind that is predicated on existing technology, existing processes, and an existing way of getting to market, and you are profiting from that business, then one of the challenges is that the quarter-on-quarter profit motivation is going to pretty much actually drive many businesses to not want to take their eyes off that profit machine. And that means that the incumbents are going to find it extremely difficult to unravel from their existing distribution mechanisms and from their existing processes, right? The other thing which is going to sort of take front stage and is going to be a bit of a challenge is going to be protectionism, right? So while there is good reason to be protective about one's own economy or perhaps one's own business arena, the problem is that the cloud has made everything possible everywhere, right? And I've been through the Singapore FinTech Festival just now. I think a lot of nation states are getting to understand that money is becoming more and more digital, and that there is going to be a huge place for CBDCs and also well-regulated stable coins, right? which means that the availability of capital is going to be pretty easy across borders, as long as it's, you know, within reasonable regulation and so on and so forth. So essentially what we are coming to a situation where the incumbents are going to find it extremely difficult to compete against the availability of data, the availability of capital, and you know, and the immediate fungibility of ideas. So I don't know if those, you know, if I'm making myself clear enough through this, but I would say that if I was an incumbent today, and I did not have the monopolistic backing of, you know, of an authority of some kind, then I would be pretty shaky.
a little concerned.
Yes, a little concerned. I would pause before I took my next sip of tea.
So let's stay with the incumbents, as you call them, and you know, because most of the airtime, most of the talk is around, as you say, the new kids on the block in finance. I'd like to ask a question about the incumbents, the old traditional banking institutions. In particular, what current conversations are you having with them, new tech development and deployment? And then if we can sort of look at competitive advantages. They want competitive advantages. How are they getting that? And thereafter, let's go into open banking. But first, let's start with the new tech development and deployment. What sort of conversations are you having with the old traditional banking institutions?
So two things. I'd say that when I talk about incumbents, I'm not taking a broad brush and saying all banks are incumbents. That's not what I'm saying. Far from it. There are some banks which are extremely progressive, right? There are some banks which are completely remodeling themselves, and they've been doing it with a strategic vision, which I will not name, is, you know, a huge global bank, massive. It's probably the first name that comes to mind when you think about retail banking, you know? And that bank went on a journey, and I was fortunate to be actually in some small part associated with that journey of massively cutting their retail operations across multiple geographies at a point of time when people said, this is completely insane. Why would you do that? Right. But then as you look at the advance of technology and the advance of AI and the advance of predictive models, the advance of, you know, communications, the metaverse, all of it, suddenly, all of a sudden, the need for a retail presence in multiple markets just doesn't make sense. And if you look at it going forward 5 years, it makes absolutely no sense for that kind of an institution to continue to possess. And I think that kind of institution, which has that strategic vision, which is looking 20 years into the future, already saw it coming and already knew what to do, and therefore made the decisions about completely dismantling their existing infrastructure in many ways, and of course recreating themselves from scratch. So I'd say if I look at that company 5 years from now, I'd say it's probably going to be a dominant bank. It already is one. It's just going to be even more dominant than before. So that's one, you know, one kind of bank. And on the other hand, there are banks that are going to continue to, you know, compete based on a protective environment, ecosystem, and within which they exist. And they're going to try and, you know, leverage the fact that they have relationships or, you know, an association with the overall economy of that nation. And therefore, they're going to try to not make the change as quickly as possible, resist the change to the best extent. Of course, they will pay lip service to digitization. But I don't think that they will probably, I don't think that they will be the most the poster boys or the poster.
Why do you say lip service to digitalization?
Okay, and that brings me back to what, you know, you asked me, like, what are the kind of conversations I have? I see a clear divide in the conversations that I'm having with the incumbents, right? So there are the banks there are the financial institutions. I wouldn't say banks, but the financial institutions and even non-financial institutions which should come up and say, listen, we want to do something this way. And they would come up with a completely new way of getting business done. Now, it means that you rethink how money flows. You rethink how money is made available to the entrepreneur. You rethink how money is, you know, moves from one place to another. And that's a rethinking, right? It's not looking at enhancing the existing model. And so that's one kind of conversation.
Oh, okay.
And the other kind of conversation is, hey, we have this process. Can you make it more efficient? What can generative AI do to make me, you know, reduce, 500 staff? Now, that is not a great conversation, right? The second one is not a great conversation. It means that you're stuck to an old model. You're stuck to old products. You believe that the world will continue to exist in exactly the same way.
You're trying to make all the new stuff fit in.
And you're trying to make all the new stuff fit in. And, you know, you can do that. You can absolutely do that because, you know, you are protected in some form or manner. But then what does it do for the overall economy? What does it do for the people that are being that you're serving, right? You're suddenly creating this digital divide between those who are well-served and those who are not. That's sort of, anyway. But that's, so I hope you get a sense of what I'm, you know, getting at and saying that there is a clear demarcation between those who see it and those who see it, but refuse to see it in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And I think you've covered the subsets of the conversation when we talked about competitive advantage and open banking. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that I've not sort of included as a subset of the conversations you were having that you'd like to share with my listeners?
Certainly. I think, you know, the opportunity, as you look at the way wealth is moving around, right, around the world, there are several new trends which have, created new pools of wealth. And I'd say wealth without using the word capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the easiest example to come across, the one that comes straight to mind, are all the crypto billionaires, right? So that's one pool of funds. But it's not the biggest pool of funds, right? There are economies which have shaken themselves out of sluggishness, and are charging along at super, it's at an enormously massive rates of growth. Mm-hmm. China was an engine for growth. India is now an engine for growth. Vietnam is just charging along like crazy, mm-hmm. And you look around, and Asia is just booming. Right, there's no other word for it. Indonesia is an amazing story on its own. So if you look at it, there's a lot of wealth being created around the world in multiple pockets for multiple reasons. And I think, you know, when you go back to that same premise of labor plus talent creates wealth, then all of a sudden you have this massive new opportunities, these new pools of wealth being created. Also, what happens is that concurrently at the same time, the world is, you know, facing some level of conflict. And I wouldn't say it's disastrous, but there are pockets of conflict. And wealth tends to move to where it's safest. So you see the concentration of wealth in a few centers, right? And I just happen to be fortuitously in those centers, right? I just happen to be in Dubai. I just happen to be in Singapore. I would love to say that I planned it 20 years ahead, but...
Of course you did, Sanjeev. You did plan it.
Well, and of course, as I'm currently speaking, I'm actually speaking from Delhi. And I look at what's going on around me, and it just completely rocked me. You know, the aspirations of people, the immense sense of liberation that you find, and the expression for that liberation. In terms of wanting to get the latest, see the best, be experience the best. It's just amazing, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and where does this sort of, you know, what happens to that wealth? And then people start, you know, young people start looking at where would I like to be next? And, you know, I'd absolutely love to have that, you know, that studio apartment overlooking the river in Singapore. Mm. And you know, it's straight away, Singapore becomes a center of wealth. And, you know, Dubai has amazing experiences and, all of a sudden. So I would say that the creation of wealth, the management of wealth is an opportunity. And it's happening in a way that's far more democratized than was ever before. So I think that there is an opportunity, finally, with the combination of technology and generative AI, to start actually including people who are outside that sector of opportunity, the segments of opportunity. And you can see it around. You still see the poverty, but at least you know that, you know, a lot of that information gap, that social friction that didn't allow people to move from one level to another, is actually going away, right?
Yeah.
Access to mobile phones, to smartphones, it's like in everybody's hands.
Beginning of it, wasn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, and data is so inexpensive in the markets that I operate in. It's just so amazingly inexpensive, right? So people just consume data and they consume information and they want to move on. Everybody has aspirations. And, you know, and now it's a question of, okay, if I can't get up the hierarchy through the normal, you know, company route, let me start something, you know, let me start my own food delivery service. Let me start my own you know, nail polishing, whatever, right? And there's a market for it.
I think it's good that you talked about the growth, the exponential growth in parts of Asia. And I kind of want to look at sort of investment in fintech. And I'm sort of wondering, has it sort of reached its peak in areas like Europe and perhaps in the US? And I want to know where the concentration, where the VCs are moving to in terms of investment and putting capital. If you could actually just give us a sort of sense of the geographical region. I know you just talked about Indonesia, but just a geographical region where fintech is really booming and where fintech is slowing. And perhaps if afterwards, if you could talk about some, maybe the service lines and industries.
Thank you. I really can't comment about the Americas, because I haven't operated in those markets. I have actually. I was in Canada last month, and I was looking around. I did actually go to an accelerator in the Okanagan Valley, and I was, I would say, unpleasantly surprised by the, you know, lack of motivation It was surprising.
Yeah.
But I don't take that as symptomatic. I don't. It was just an incident. Pardon me?
It was just a surface view.
It was a very, very surface view. Very surface view. So it's completely wrong of me to comment about. It's inappropriate for me to comment about what's happening in North America, or South America for that matter, because I don't really have much of contact with those markets.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that it's not so much where the VCs are going in. And again, the VC world is an extremely interesting world, because I think as the money supply sort of becomes more expensive, it's VCs are becoming a lot more cautious in terms of what ventures they're actually funding, right? These have to be ventures that drive results that are not just valuation based, but are also profitability focused.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the VC world, which was looking at the speculative growth, has sort of got tempered a bit. It'll never get over. It'll just get tempered a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think the VCs who are more expert in the area of financial services actually got people on board who have been, you know, part of, like I have, you know, of the actual scrum of working in the markets, of actually creating distribution networks, of working with people, of talking face-to-face. Those kind of people who understand what the blood, sweat, and tears that it takes to actually build a business, those kind of VCs are probably going to be looking for those companies that have that right passion or that right strength and the right fiber to be able to go forward with their business ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where there's going to be a difference. And if you look at it realistically, it's going to be that strength, that fiber, that drive for, you know, getting out of whatever situation they're in right now, is probably going to be coming from the markets in Asia and Africa. Okay, and it kind of goes back, and I keep coming back to that theme of, you know, the availability of talent,
yes,
and labor together, plus the drive to grow, the
opportunity,
right? the opportunity, and plus the drive to grow. So. Yeah, it's not going to happen in markets in places where the political environment is completely against any kind of, you know, there it's going to be, it's a sorry state for people in those countries, you know, and one can only commensurate with them and say that it's sad. But I think in most of the countries which have somewhat of an opening economy, there is a huge amount of focus on growth.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, I actually thought perhaps, you know, in a maybe a fairly unstable political environment, that will increase the drive of individuals to sort of develop and rise above all of that. But you're saying,
yes,
yeah.
No, I agree with you.
All right. Okay.
I agree with you. So that's a good point. Let me clarify exactly what I was saying. There are somewhat repressive regimes, right?
Yeah.
Which have the opportunity to take talent away from to take away the opportunity from people, right? And those economies are the ones which are repressive. Those are the ones which are highly controlled. They're stable but highly controlled, right? I think that's where there's a problem. It's not where there is instability. It's open. It's relatively more open. It's a little more, you know, there's a little more, there's a little less control.
Not fully regulated, so to speak, So
it's not, yeah, got
okay.
it.
That, no, that's fine, got that's it. Fine. I wanted to ask, because, you know, we talked a little bit about the VCs. I want to ask about what you're talking to the VCs about and what the startups are saying. I mean, you spend time talking to VCs, and I'm sure you spend a lot of time talking to startups. The question I want answered is, where do they not have meeting of minds? Where do you see the frustration in those two bodies?
So that's a good question. I'd say I'm going to go on the basis of a couple of conversations. So I don't have evidence to say this. So please don't. You know, please don't take this as the truth.
Yep.
But I do feel that many of the startups that had looked at an exit on the basis of a very slick, presentation or a reasonably slick or slick technology, without the go-to-market that's required for it, are feeling the pinch. So their funding has sort of dried up. And many of them are sort of now trying to figure out what do they do with their technology. In many cases, there is really no way forward for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think also at the same time, the VCs that were sort of involved in the VCs are transforming, obviously.
Yeah.
VCs, they're the sharpest financial minds in the market, right? And so what they're doing is that they're basically saying that, listen, as we change our business model and we look for actual bottom line, right? It's frustrating that the startups don't understand that. So in a way, the startups are almost acting like incumbents in the sense that they had a business model, they had we'll go with bootstrapping, then we'll get some seed funding, then we'll go to an angel, and then we'll get some Series A, Series B, blah, 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 and all that stuff is what they're still looking at. And I don't know if those models still are viable.
Or work today.
Yeah, I think it's straightforward, honest, hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Get a profitable business going. Show profitability in 18 months of starting up. And, you show the revenue coming in and people will say, okay, and show scalability, show how you can move your business from A to B and without enormous effort, and then you have a business.
Well, those conversations are going to continue. Let's move on. I've asked this question in a previous series and was provided with some great and interesting thoughts and analysis. So I'm going to continue with it here. So apart from the buzz around AI and generative AI, and I know it's pretty difficult to think beyond that, but apart from the buzz around that, what else is new and disrupting fintech, or a subset of it? I mean, what's currently being talked about on forums such as LinkedIn that you'd like to share?
Actually, yes, generative AI takes the popular, takes.
I know, that's why I said apart from them.
But there's a lot of, there's a huge amount of work that's happening in areas which are in some way related, actually. One of them is definitely related to AI. And that area is cybersecurity, right? So how do you protect assets? How do you protect businesses? How do you protect companies in today's world? And that's honestly an area that I am learning about, right? I had an opportunity to learn about it about 3 years ago, but I did not take that opportunity. But I'm pretty soon going to be correcting that, because I think that, I can do it right now. And I think cybersecurity is a massive, opportunity for people of the right kind of intellectual skills, and surprisingly for the non-technical skills. I often say this about you know, my wife, Harvina, she's a journalist. You know, she's been an editor of newspapers, and she's got this immense ability, amazing ability to look at something and pick out something out of pattern in a page, you know, in a huge newspaper page, you know, in the old newspaper pages, you could have this huge, you know, she could pick out something by just looking at that page. And that ability to look at something out of pattern is there with only a few individuals. They're not necessarily technical people, right?
Yeah. Yes.
They are artists. They are people who use language. They're creative. And I think we have sort of done a disservice by, you know, divorcing the creative world from the technical world in many ways, other than a few companies like Apple, of course, which brought the two together. But I think there's this huge opportunity of tapping into cognitive talent, which is not technical, right? Or creative talent even, which is not technical. So that's one area.
Mm-hmm.
The other area which I'm very, very interested in is, you know, you know, of course, I always talk about the world of wealth management, which is an immensely powerful area right now. I would say that is also an area of immense interest. But I think more than that, more than just the wealth, digital wealth and physical wealth, is the interest in digital currencies, right? And I was fortunate enough to actually have the opportunity to speak one-on-one to David Shaw, you know, the person who many people regard as, you know, probably the person who helped formulate the thoughts about Bitcoin in the first place, right? And we had this one-on-one conversation at the Singapore FinTech Festival, and he was presenting about, he made a presentation about something called Better Than Money. And, you know, I would highly encourage people who are listening to this podcast to actually go and follow David Shaw if they don't already know who he is. I'm sure most people do, but if they don't, definitely follow him. And have a look at his new initiative called Better Than Money. And it's interesting because in his view, it comes back to what, you know, Elon Musk was saying, as long as there's a combination of labor and talent, you'll be able to create a lot of wealth. What he's saying is that everything is fungible, right? You know, the stuff that you own at home is fungible. You can change that into an asset. You can use that to trade, right? You don't, it's not like as if everything is sunken money. We had sort of got to that concept of the shared economy and Airbnb and Uber, you know, a couple of decades ago. But I think now we are coming to a more granular level of understanding of what an asset is. So it's not like as if that thing that's lying in your house that hasn't been used for the last 20 years is actually without value. It probably has value to somebody somewhere. How do you make it fungible?
The open view of assets, not like sort of old-fashioned closed view of what assets are.
Right. So I think that's an immensely interesting area right now. The whole area of central bank digital currencies, regulated stable coins, you know, alternate forms of money, those are all very, very interesting views. And there's this huge debate about whether, you know, cryptocurrencies are actually currencies or whether they're stores of assets and so on and so forth. All that's back and forth. That's a lot of intellectualism, right? The fact is that if you allow people to make their stuff fungible in whichever form or manner, and they can actually use it and unlock their money because it's valuable to somebody somewhere in the world, right? You've already created a new set of a new level of wealth, right? Wealth that can be unleashed, can be used for trade, for investment, for whatever.
All right. I think let's continue talking about inspirational individuals, especially in your area of work. And I was wondering, you mentioned one, I was wondering, who else influences you in fintech and banking and why? Apart from your wife, of course, but
yeah, I'm going to be very parochial. I'm going to be very parochial about this. Okay, and definitely the president of Singapore, Tharman Shanmugaratnam.
Right.
You know, he is. I mean, he is just an amazing individual because he was at one point of time the head of the Monetary Authority of Singapore. The the regulator of Singapore, so to speak. And a lot of what Singapore is today is in no small part due to the immense work that he's done. So, you know, hats off to my president. I completely admire him. The second person that I also admire a lot is the person who transformed Singapore into becoming the fintech capital of the world, Ravi Menon, you know, who is the MD of the Monetary Authority of Singapore. And of course, the most visible and energetic person possible who created this huge Singapore fintech ecosystem, Shopnendu Mohanty, the chief technical officer of you know, of the of the Monetary Authority of Singapore. These are three individuals who have been immensely powerful, in my opinion, in terms of what they've done for not just Singapore, but for the region, and what they've done in terms of being able to inspire a lot of other central banks and regulators in and around Singapore to start learning about fintech and its applicability to the financial system, right? So in a way, yes, I'm sort of, you know, taking the example of three people whom I know, and I've sort of in some
those,
way, you know,
those are three great individuals, and you know, and obviously they played a major role in how the rest of the world view Singapore. So that's fantastic, and I hope my listeners will go and check these individuals out that Sanjeev mentioned, and understand why those are always picked. Okay, let's end this episode of Ed's Talk with this question. I'm interested to hear what you've got to say about this one. If we were to have a conversation next year, Sanjeev, about trends in fintech, what do you think we'll be talking about?
Interesting. That's a very good question. I'd say that we would have sort of got to a point where we know for a fact that AI, not just generative AI, but AI is going to be immensely, it's going to be about the applications of AI. And that's a conversation that I'm in right now with one of the companies that I represent, Apex. Probably, again, you know, a strong plug for Apex, which is one of the world's best innovation platforms, right? It's a platform, again, built by the Monetary Authority of Singapore and the World Bank, the IOC, to enable banks to transform digitally. So it's basically a fintech marketplace plus, you know, a testing bed for banks to test out products before they buy them. And it reduces the cost of finding technology and using it, you know, by 10x or even more, because it just crashes the cost of discovering technology and using it. And so Apex is one of those interesting companies, APIX, that sort of, you know, enables this. And I think that that piece, that the part about being able to use various applications that are afforded by artificial intelligence, is something that through Apex we started having that conversation. How do you bring in the CFOs and the CEOs and the CTOs of large banks together in a room along with the founders of the best AI companies and have them have a conversation with each other without any of the commentary, right? How do these guys talk to each other? And we do these kind of these afternoons or, you know, or mornings where we bring them together. And I think that's where the conversation next year, you're going to see the results of these conversations. Right. And these conversations are happening. Unfortunately, we've done them in Singapore. We would like to take them to other parts of the world. But, you know, and I think that's one very critical area. The other area that I also feel is also highly relevant, again, relating to where I live in Dubai, the COP28 movement. I mean, COP28 and the whole climate change question. The other conversation is going to be around, I just recently brought out a book along with four of my co-authors, you know, which is called The Global ESG Book 2024. And that book was, you know, written along with, was co-authored with Tracy Lai, Koen van der Doink, and Mona Zoet, and Matt Bird. So we brought this book out, which is a collection of about 17 or 18 essays from people around the world on how financial services and fintech is going to impact the way we manage to meet the goals of climate change by 2030, right? So it's investing in the right companies, finding the right technologies. So that's, again, another big conversation that's going to happen about, you know, it's I think more and more people are sort of beginning to understand that it's not about melting glaciers so much as about sustainability of business models, right? It's about sustained and equitable growth. And some of the practices that have come out of the ESG model have actually been good for companies to relook at their governance, to relook at the way they waste, to relook at the way they, you know, they create a sustainable business model for themselves going forward. And I think one of the studies, I can't quote the study offhand, said 9.1% increase in profitability amongst the 1,262 companies that adopted ESG principles, leading to about a $4 trillion increase in overall profitability. So that's how big the pie is, right? The companies that actually use technology, and especially for financial services organizations to start investing in those companies that show a strong motivation to relook at themselves, to reduce waste, to make their own systems more, their own processes more sustainable. Those are the companies that need to be invested in. So that's the second conversation that I feel that is going to be of immense importance in next. I think these two are the two. The applicability of AI at a senior level between the founders of AI and the founders of financial institutions, or the people who run the financial services world, and the people who are responsible for the overall sustainability of our planet. So those are two trends that I see.
That's a really interesting reply to that answer. Thank you very much for that. There's one or two replies that will be released in its due course, but that's a really interesting one, and we look forward to that next year. Sanjeev Purushottam, a wonderful conversation today on Headstorm. Many thanks for your time and insights.
Oh, Lynn, thank you so much for being such a wonderful, wonderful host, because when I do sessions like this myself, sometimes I, you know, you can probably have made out that I can talk quite a bit, right? So,
but it's interesting stuff. That's why I just said, let me just listen. Because if I cut into there, listeners will say, why did you cut in at that point, you know? So, no way, I'm listening to this.
Yeah, so I think the most important thing is, Elaine, you came across as somebody who was patient and willing to let me say my piece, right?
Yes.
And I was clearly, for whatever reason, I was in the zone during this particular talk. I don't know what you had done, how you had created that environment, that ecosystem. I think the set of questions that you sent, the preparation, you know, you had literally got me into the zone over a period of time.
Yes.
So come 3:30, I was in the zone. I was like, you know, I was...
I know it could have been another 2 hours. We could have talked in greater detail in terms about the relationship with VCs and startups. I knew you were getting there, and it was sort of steering you away from that to generative AI, then away from that. But I knew there was so much more we could talk about. But you know, there was always these little break points to move on to the next bit, which I just thought was fantastic.
No, it was fantastic. So I really appreciated the way you prepped, right? And I think that's something which I will learn a lot from. Yes. I think oftentimes you've got this sort of old-fashioned way of doing things, you know, which is so different from, you know, somebody coming up to you with a mic in the middle of a show and saying, can you give us 3 comments on blah blah blah, and you're like, so, you know what I say, my mind is somewhere else.
Yes. The point is, you research the individual you're going to talk to, you look at what subjects interest them, you look at a bit of their background, and then you ask questions related to that. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, unfortunately, in a world of Instagram,
exactly. People haven't got the time to learn, which is unfortunate. People haven't got the time to research, and that's what we do.
Amazing, absolutely amazing.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Heads Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via my website, elainepringle.com/headstalk, or wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'd like to thank our sponsors, guests, and you for helping to make the show possible. Please join me next time where I'll be featuring more executives, C-suite leaders, and heads of multinationals.
Heads Talk podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.